Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we will be talking about Indian boarding schools, and some of the content will be disturbing. Today's guest, Washington Post reporter Dana Hedgepeth, has done extensive reporting on the 523 Indian boarding schools established in the United States. She and her colleagues write that religious groups received federal contracts to operate about a third of them. Families were often coerced by federal agents or priests to send their children. A year-long investigation has documented that 3,104 students died at boarding schools between 1828 and 1970, three times as many deaths as reported by the U.S. Interior Department last year. The Post found that more than 800 of those students are buried in cemeteries at or near the schools they attended, underscoring how, in many cases, children's bodies were never sent home to their families or tribes. The Post's investigation found the deaths by drawing on hundreds of thousands of government documents that also revealed how children were beaten and harshly punished if they did not adhere to strict rules in the classroom and in the fields, laundry rooms, kitchens, or workshops, where they often were forced to spend half of their days. Last week, Dana Hedgepeth reported that two Native American tribes filed a class action lawsuit against the U.S. government for its role in running a system that separated Native children from their families to eradicate their languages and culture and force them to assimilate into white society. Dana Hedgepeth is a Native American journalist who has been at the Washington Post for 25 years. She's an enrolled member of the Halawa Saponi tribe of North Carolina. Hi, Dana. Thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is great to have you. I have to say, I'm so glad that the Washington Post has decided to spend so much time and resources doing this reporting. So huge thanks to you and your colleagues. When did you begin reporting on Indian boarding schools?
Thanks for asking, Rose. It is a big step that the Washington Post, paper that most of our readers are non-native and has really wanted to shine a light on that. And I started doing work on Indian boarding schools in 2023. One of the first pieces I did was looking at four survivors who'd gone to these schools. And I had a really inspiring editor, Linda Robinson, who encouraged me to find folks to tell those stories, right? Because sadly, we're all getting older, but especially those who went to the schools when they were incredibly tough and they were very mistreated, these children there, and find them as adults and get them to really go deep and hear those first-person voices are just so important to hear. They won't be around and getting them documented. So that's where I first started. And then I paired up with my colleagues, Sari Horowitz, who's a longtime Washington Post reporter here. She's been here for 40 years on our national investigative team, has long had an interest in Indian country stories. And we teamed up to do something deeper and pitched a longer investigation that we spent about a year on, looking into sexual abuse across the country at these schools. As you mentioned, I think we found over 1,000 children were abused by priests, nuns, and brothers at dozens of schools across the country. And then our second big piece was looking at the deaths, where 3,100 children, that's three times more than what the Interior investigation found, died at these schools. And many of them, sadly, were buried on cemeteries on the school's grounds. And as one of the survivors that I've talked to often says, it's a sad but true line, which is, I have my own two young children, Rose, and my children's school, thankfully, does not have a cemetery on the grounds. No school, as we know. As I say that, I have chills running down me and I run hot. No school should have a cemetery, right?
Wow. I often wonder, we do a lot of shows about history on this show, and my dad's side of the family is Native, you're Native, and so we do more shows about Native issues than I'm guessing a lot of public radio shows, because we often talk about where we come from. That's just how it works. That's why diversity is also so important. And I often wonder how many people in this country, and I know it's so hard to know this, but how many people know much about these Indian boarding schools? I mean, again, I'm so grateful because some of the reports you did, I remember when they came out, Dana, and online, that's where I read the Washington Post, that the graphics are just so chilling and there's these reports are so in depth. And it really made me pause and think, oh my gosh, this is amazing, because so many people who read the Washington Post for political news and what's going on the Capitol are reading this. And so what you said earlier, most of the Post readers are non-native. What kind of response have you received to these investigations?
I'm so glad you asked this, and you hit the nail on the head. I'm smiling even though you can't see my face because you just get it so well. It was interesting, a couple of thoughts. As we were reporting this, my colleague Sari is much more social than I am. I'm a little bit of a misanthrope, and I loved hearing that when she would go to places and tell people, or sometimes we would go together socially, and people would say, what are you working on? And we would say Indian boarding schools. And Washington is a town of very educated, very smart folks, and people would look at us quizzically and they didn't know what we were talking about. And sometimes we would get the reaction of people would say, oh, you mean like a boarding school in the upper northeast area, like Cambridge? And I would interject if I was there and say, it's not that kind, it's not your father's kind of boarding school. There were so many people who had never heard of an Indian boarding school, quote, I'm doing air quotes, quote unquote, educated folks. I'm not blaming, I'm just stating in pure fact here, Rose. Folks don't know what you don't know, as my dad would say. They just never heard of it. We got emails from professors and very well-educated people all over the country who said, I'm from a certain area and I knew that there was a quote Indian school, but I knew nothing about it. Thank you for shedding the light. We got emails, comments from so many native readers too, people who were sources of ours, or we had talked to dozens and dozens of interviews, who said, I had to stop when I scrolled down and saw my grandmother's name in that. It hit them so hard, the emotions of that. On the online version, which you mentioned you read, and we ran a special section in print of those 3,104 names of children who died in Indian boarding schools. We didn't have names for all of the children. We had names for about half of them. But even if we didn't have their name, we used a little figurine to validate and to sort of showcase. Our designers did an incredible job of taking this idea that I had a tough time articulating, of saying, how can we honor these children so that every child matters? Wow. And they took that and came up with this great design where, as you scrolled, the figures popped up. And it gave you a sense, Rose, of like, what does 3,100 names look like? Instead of just running a list, as you scrolled and those names and those figures popped up, so many people said, that really impacted me. And I'm patting my chest. People could really relate to that. And so many of our native readers wrote into me and said, wow, when I saw my grandmother's name, I had heard oral histories passed down. When I saw it in writing, there's something powerful about that. There's something validating, powerful yet also painful, right? Because that's showing that there's proof that someone's grandmother, a great aunt or great uncle went to that school. And for so long, this history has been hidden, ignored, pushed aside, and just not, the light has not been shed on it. And that's what we were trying to do, is shed a light, and shed a light on this history.
That's amazing. And I'm looking at the piece right now, and we could spend that whole hour mentioning these names, and I'll mention a few. Neil Sweeson, 22, Nora Izancho, 11, Mira Kicha, 21, Caleb Ketchajoyle, 16, Samson Noran, 18, Susie Nachikia, 14, Henry Morning, 18. It just goes on and on. And Dana, it's so interesting to hear you say that these highly educated, very smart people in Washington, D.C. didn't know much about Indian boarding schools. And, you know, we had a few Native scholars on a few weeks ago to talk about this political moment and Trump's second term as he quickly once again moves to whitewash U.S. history. And one of the questions we talked about is, why is it that this country just has failed to come to terms with its past, and people have different answers for that. But it's just incredible that even basic knowledge about Native history is still not known to so many people, like you're talking about, incredibly smart people who've gone to the elite schools of the country living in Washington, D.C.
Wow, Rose, you ask great questions. I'm smiling. Another great question. I'm going to answer this in a couple of different ways. We did a sort of a third piece that I should mention, and it was headlined, They Took the Children, and had a very powerful photo of Native children in their clothing. And that headline we took from, I believe it was Deb Parker, the head of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, known as NABS for short. And they really did take the children. Some children were as young as 4 or 5 years old. Mm. Some, quote, children, I'm doing air quotes, were older when they were at the school. And people have asked me about that. Why were they there for so long? And the reason is, Native American scholar had told me, studied the schools for a long time, said that they would keep some of the older boys who had started the schools, young boys, they'd keep them all the way till they were 18, 21, 22 years old, because they used them as manual labor. They used them to keep up the school. There were fields to be worked. The students didn't get to eat the best of the vegetables and crops that were raised. Those were sold or given to the teachers and those who worked there, but it was manual labor. And even when I say that, it still just makes me cringe a bit, because they sort of force these kids or coerce their parents and then kept them there longer than they should have been simply for the physical labor that they provided. I find that just heartbreaking. They were still children, and I feel like that headline was so powerful. That piece, They Took the Children, was, again, a special section of about 4 pages, Rose, and what we did, I realized in talking to my colleagues and people as we were doing it, I told my colleague Sari, I said, so often we were working with a lot of different departments at the Washington Post. All in all, there's about 61 people involved with our project, and we were so grateful and so blessed to have that kind of resource. We had audio folks, we had graphic people, we had visual forensic folks looking for where children were buried. We had editors, we had video photographers. But what I realized is that people, the history, the context of how did this happen? So often people would ask me, how did this happen? I don't understand what the context is. How could this quote unquote great country allow this to happen? And I said, this was all orchestrated, part of a broader Indian policy the U.S. government had, Congress endorsed, to, as Richard Henry Pratt said, the founder of Carlisle, the first large Indian boarding school, famously, infamously said, kill the Indian in him, save the man. This was part of a large land grab that if you take a nation's children, if you take their children, that is their future. That is a way to crush people. They had tried Indian wars. They had tried disease. They still could not kill the Indian. Resilient people. You go for their children, Rose, and you're talking about literally cutting off people from their language, which is how we survive, from their culture. These are passed down traditions. You take a child who's 4 or 5, you have cut off their connection to their community. There is sadly no better way to break a people, whether we are purple, black, white, yellow, or polka dot, than to take their children. It was the ultimate weaponization. They used education as a weapon against Indian people. And we ran that section to give context to show how far back it went. It started with the 1819 Civilization Act. And again, I was so thankful that my editors and really smart people of design folks heard that. I'm history obsessed, in particular with Native history. But I kept saying to my colleague, she would always tease me, Danny, you're so into history. And I said, we got to figure out a way to make this into bite-sized pieces so people can understand the broader context. Because so much had happened to bring about these schools in U.S. policy. And we came up with a way, and again, our great designers pulled that into a section, and you could scroll down and pop up parts of it, and you could get very detailed or just get the broad overview. But that, again, we got feedback from people, Rose, who said, I never knew this. People who were, quote unquote, very educated said, I never knew this. They didn't have the broad context of it. And that's so important, I feel, for Native history, for anyone's history. But Natives were here first, and they have a very deep, deep history. Brenda Childs, who's an amazing Native historian, always says, you know, boil it down as quickly as you can. You're talking about hundreds of years of history, but to try to give some of that context. And that's what we tried to do, because it people don't know it, sadly. They're curious, though. That's the good news. And they want to hear it. And we have to find ways to share it with them that's in a digestible way, because it is a lot to take in.
Right. Well, anytime we do shows about this, we always get really incredible questions from listeners, people saying, thank you for talking about this. So you're right. I think people really are hungry for this information, especially at a time now when the Trump administration is once again moving very quickly to whitewash U.S. history. Today, we're spending the hour with Dana Hedgepeth, a Native American journalist who's been at the Washington Post for 25 years. Dana is an enrolled member of the Halawa Saupani tribe of North Carolina, and she's been doing extensive reporting on Indian boarding schools. Let's talk about some basic facts here. So you and your colleagues report that there were at least 523 Indian boarding schools established in the United States. How do we know that it's 523?
Very good question. Let's back up a little bit. That it, starting in 2021, Deb Haaland, first Native American cabinet secretary, she started an investigation, and she made it a real big priority of her department to look into these boarding schools. That was the first time that anyone in modern times had really shined a light on these schools. And that is something to be emphasized and recognized, because right before she launched that investigation, the sad story in Canada at the Kamloops School, where there had been detection of possible graves of over 200 children, that set up a national, international rose headlines of people who'd never even heard about, in Canada they call them residential schools. And that slowly started the trickle to the U.S., where the U.S. started saying, there were people who were saying, wait, we have these same schools? An interesting fact is actually the schools in Canada were modeled after the ones here in the United States, and we had a much larger system than they did. It was literally a systematic effort. The schools were paid for having students. They got $167 per head, so literally the more students you have, the more money you make. Of those 523 schools, some were run by the federal government, and some were run under contracts with various religious institutions, just like we run contracts today. We're all familiar with the federal government running contracts, and you got paid for those schools. What was so significant also about Haaland's investigation is, believe it or not, no one had ever done a count of how many boarding schools there were. In all of the year's history, these schools started in the late 1800s, ran all the way up to most of them until the late 1960s, and no one had actually done a comprehensive list of where physically were these schools located and the full names of them. Some of them had changed names. If a Catholic order took over, it would change to a different order, but no one had done a comprehensive look at that. And that was a huge undertaking. Much of Deb Haaland's first report focused on that. And I think that often it sounds small, but it's really big when you talk about history just being ignored. And she really did an forensic accounting in a way of just where these schools were, which was very big in Indian country and should not go unmentioned. And then in her second report, she delved into more of the details of what happened at these schools. And then our work took that a step further of digging further into the graves and the number of children that actually died at these schools. Her team focused looking at U.S. government records. We took that a step further, looking not just at U.S. government records, but thousands of records at the National Archives, which has unbelievable documents. We looked at historical records from universities, from tribes, from private collections. There are lots of folks, actually, who I say have been keeping tabs on this for years at individual schools. We talked to researchers in Oregon who'd been working on one particular school for 20 years. They'd been collecting names of children who'd gone there and what had happened to them and where they had been buried and whether or not they'd been sent home. They're wonderful researchers, highly skilled, and I think they were just so eager and willing to help us. And I often talk to them multiple times a week and said, why are you willing to help us? And they said, because we've been waiting for this kind of call. Wow. We've been waiting for a big paper to call us and share this information so that we can get it to a bigger audience so people can understand this dark, dark history.
When you talked about Deb Holland, I was just again thinking about the importance of diversity. Here we have the first Native American to serve as a cabinet secretary, and this is in 2021. So President Biden nominated Deb Holland to be the Secretary of the Interior. She served from 2021 to 2025. She wrote a piece in the Washington Post, June 2021, "My Grandparents Were Stolen From Their Families as Children." She writes about how her maternal grandparents were stolen from their families when they were only 8 and were forced to live away from their parents' culture and communities until they were 13. And so she starts this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Dana, I mean, imagine if she hadn't been appointed. I mean, we might be having this conversation because you're a Native American journalist who's interested in this. But again, this is why we need people from different backgrounds in all levels of society so we uncover the truths about history and so many other reasons, of course.
You're right. And Deb Holland, being that she is Laguna Pueblo from New Mexico, she got it, right? She grew up knowing these stories of her very own people. One of her relatives went to Carlisle. She had heard these stories, so they were not unfamiliar to her. Brian Newland, one of her top assistant secretaries, who was wrote the report, whose name was on both reports, also relatives who went to. This is not a new story for those of Indian country. It's such a sad quote, but it's such a true quote of Deb Holland. She would say this often, is there is, you will not find a person in Indian country, hard-pressed to find a person in Indian country who's not been impacted in some ways by Indian boarding schools. The reason she was the perfect person for that job to pursue this investigation is she realized very quickly that Indian people, you go to where they are. We are storytellers. We are oral storytellers. She didn't have people come to Washington to tell her the story. She went to them. She traveled around to 12 or 13 spots all over the country. She went to community centers, to tribal centers, and she sat and she listened. And that is the key of what made her so successful. She called it her Road to Healing tour. And she had just an open mic. And she and Secretary Brian Newland sat for hours without saying. She didn't give a big speech. She gave very minor introductions. We went to a couple of these, to one in particular, to Lalep, and she would give very minor remarks, and then she would sit for hours and listen to people tell their stories. That resonated so much with people, to have a cabinet-level secretary to take 12 to 13 road trips and listen to people and sit for hours and have nothing on her agenda. And it was powerful, and it gave people such a respect and acknowledgement that they had never gotten. Remember, she's a cabinet secretary, not just of any cabinet, of the Interior, which Interior was the very department that helped create and manage these boarding schools. So she's shining a light and scrutinizing her very own department. And in a nutshell, her two reports said these children were mistreated by the United States government. That's powerful. Very few leaders call out the very agency that they run and said wrong was done. That was a huge impetus for how the Biden apology came about in October. And shortly after our first story on the sexual abuse happened, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops issued a formal apology, also saying and admitting their wrongdoings and the trauma that these children suffered. A lot of this movement, again, it was a reckoning. So many people say Deb Holland started a reckoning of this here in the United States, and she really did. She, in a way, was the Secretary of Indian Country. Yes, she was Secretary of Interior Department, but I heard someone say, you know, she was really Secretary of Indian Country, because without her, I don't think this issue would have gotten it would not have come out in a way that it did under her leadership. And already we're seeing that change. I wrote a story just in April about how the National Endowment for the Humanities had cut about $1.5 million in grants to do some digitizing of archival records related to Indian boarding schools and collections that are being done of first-person interviews. There's many groups that are trying to get first-person accounts from survivors, again, before they pass away. And some of that work that they're doing has been cut under the new administration, sadly. Mm. And that's the big difference that we're seeing right now, though, some of that work that had been started under the Biden and Holland is now changing, and folks are started the work and they're hoping that they can finish it. It remains unclear.
In that piece, you quoted Deborah Parker, chief executive of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, who said, "We got nearly $500,000 cut from us overnight. Some employees whose work is supported by the NEH grant were in tears." She said, "This is absolutely disappointing and heartbreaking." Before we go to break, Dana, what is the status of this listening tour and all of the information that has been gathered now that Trump is back in the White House?
Well, Secretary Holland finished her listening tour during her time, and all of that work that she, those recordings are still being worked on at this point, as far as we know, and that will be ultimately, a lot of it was in her reports already. Deb Parker's group is taking it a step further of getting these oral histories recorded, and those will eventually also be shared. Her has a, I like to call her team small but mighty, because they are some of the hardest working people I know, and they have such empathy for people, and they really take their time to travel. They are going to, I think almost a dozen places to hear people's stories and give them the time and space that they need to feel to share what happened to them. And again, those experiences are so important to document it. Up until now, they really haven't been documented in a large scale. You're talking about capturing history. Again, it's so important to know those stories. Once folks pass, we've lost that. So Parker's group is still continuing that very important work. It's painstaking, it's hard, it takes time. You have to be so careful. You're talking about folks who have been traumatized, but she is continuing to do that work right now and find other ways to pay for it. There's groups in Nebraska, the Genoa Indian Industrial School that I wrote about in that same piece you read from, where they were so close to finishing some of their work of digitizing records, and they're trying to work with the University of Nebraska to find money to keep that work going, even though some of it's been cut. And I think these folks, they're very hardworking. I am impressed with how hard they work with such small budgets that they already had and small staffs. And I'm confident that they will probably be able to get that work done, because they have been so far along and they've invested so much in it. So I think that they will work very hard to try to complete this work, even without the federal government funding it. I hope that they can find other ways. I know that they've been trying to work to find other ways to keep it going so that they do have that history documented, so that we all can share and benefit from that.
You also spoke with Ben Jasek, Director of Research at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, who said, "We're going to do this work not only for our ancestors, but for those who are still here and for those who come after us and deserve to know this truth. We deserve this healing." Today, we are speaking with Dana Hedgepeth, a Native American journalist who's been at the Washington Post for 25 years. Dana is an enrolled member of the Halawa Saponi tribe of North Carolina. She and her colleagues have done extensive reporting on Indian boarding schools. We have an email from a listener who says, "Thank you for talking about Deb Holland's important contribution. I work for the Department of Interior and miss her leadership." I hope you can spend some time with these pieces that she and her colleagues wrote. So much went into this work. There's graphics, there's really incredible and haunting photos, and it's interactive. And you can find a lot of these pieces at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. We'll be back after this.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Dana Hedgepeth, a Native American journalist who has been at the Washington Post for 25 years. She's an enrolled member of the Halawa Saponi tribe of North Carolina and has done extensive reporting on the 523 Indian boarding schools established in the United States. If you have a question or a comment for Dana about Indian boarding schools, you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dana, last week you reported on a class action lawsuit filed by the Wichita and affiliated tribes of Oklahoma and the Washoe tribe of Nevada and California. And they say that the federal government failed to keep its treaty promise to Native nations in exchange for land. It would provide education for Native children. They're also suing the U.S. government for its role in running boarding schools. Has a lawsuit like this ever been filed before?
It is a unique lawsuit. There was one filed way back several decades ago, the Zephyr case, and that was thrown out of court for basically a technicality in a way. So this is sort of a unique one to try to sue the federal government. Many of the lawsuits that have been filed over Indian boarding schools have typically been to a particular church or religious order or religious group that ran the school. Survivors have sued for the mistreatment and abuse that they suffered there. And there have been some very large settlements. There was one in the Northwest for the Oregon province of the Catholic Church there that settled for well over $100 million. I believe it was close to $160 million. And we talked with the lawyers and many of the survivors who were involved in that lawsuit. They're very hard-fought cases, so it'll be really interesting to see what happens with this. No one has tried to sue the federal government in this comprehensive way as this suit is trying to do. And they're doing it in an interesting way where they're asking for an accounting of the trust funds, Native American lands that tribes were forced or coerced to, quote-unquote, sell to the federal government. The government took that money. It was supposed to be put in what's known as tribal trust accounts and for the collective use of tribes. And the government decided to use that to pay for the running of government boarding schools. So in a strange way, Native people were paying for these schools where their own children were mistreated, abused, and even died. Mm. It's kind of a dark, sad irony, Rose, in a way. So this lawsuit is taking an class action approach to that and saying that they want a full accounting of how that money was spent in hopes that they can get some justice and healing. It really is about healing for those who went there, not just those who went there, but also for their survivors and their descendants. As many descendants know so well, and I've quoted them in my story saying this, the reverberations of this, even generations later, are still felt. I have so often people say, you're writing about schools, Dana, that happened in the 1800s, early 1900s. Why does this matter now? The injuries, the pain from that is still very much a part of so many Indian communities today. And as Tasha Mansu, who's from the Wichita affiliated tribe, she's the vice president there, said in that story, she said, part of healing is accountability when you've been harmed. And that's what this is about, accountability. It is not, for many survivors, about money. It is about the accountability and the acknowledgement. This is what, as many scholars say, this is one of the darkest chapters in American history. And for so long, the federal government has not even acknowledged its role in it. And so that's what this effort is about, is trying to do that, to get people the justice to acknowledge that this did happen.
This point about intergenerational trauma is so important. In the piece, you quote Michelle Emerson, a member of the Wichita tribe, who said both of her parents attended boarding schools as children, and as a result, their marriage was short, alcohol-soaked, and violent. She said, they were never around a structured family, so they didn't know how to model it. I know they loved us, but they could never express that. I think this is so important to talk about, Dana, because it's so easy for people to make judgments and say, you know, why is there so much poverty on Indian reservations? Why is there violence? Why do we see so many women going missing? You know, what's happening there? And so much of that can be traced back to the boarding schools. I mean, you've interviewed so many people who talked about the damage that they did to their children because of what was done to them in the schools.
That's absolutely right, Rose, and I'm glad you brought that up. I am not a trauma expert, but I have talked to many trauma experts and dozens of survivors. And Native people, so often they're survivors. They are resilient people. One woman who I sat with at the gravesite in Carlisle, watching three people from the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation in Montana be exhumed, Almeda Heavy Hair, and two others from that tribe who were taken among 20 students by train all the way across the country to a place they didn't know, a language they didn't speak. And as we sat there in that cemetery and watched as the archaeologist very carefully, painstakingly removed bone by bone their grave, she said, "No school should have a cemetery." And she also said that this is something that so many tribes can relate to, sadly. Those children represented generations. And when you take someone, they don't have that continuity, right? Teaching a child love, it's a taught skill. I've talked to so many survivors who, as they get older, have reflected back on how they treated their own children and sometimes even their grandchildren. And they've said to me, I never heard the words, "I love you," growing up. How sad is that, Rose? So many of us are often blessed, thankfully, that we hear those words, right? Maybe not from a parent, but from an aunt or an uncle or a neighbor or friend, and you get an appropriate encouraging hug or pat on the back or high five. These children were disciplined for speaking their languages, or as Jim LaBelle from Alaska told me, sometimes we were beaten and we didn't even understand why. That's heartbreaking. That's how children learn love. They learn from the community they're in. And if you're in a community taken from your home and you're not learning love or discipline, proper discipline within reason, it creates a very confusing state. And when you get out of these schools or you go back to your community, if you don't have the resources to support you and understand and get the help that you need to go through that, you kind of plug through life in a way, right? You have to survive. You have to provide food for your children. And I've talked to so many survivors who are in their late 60s, 70s, even 80s, who say, "I was just trying to survive when I got back." You start having children, or you go to military service, and you're trying to make it, and you never really deal with that trauma. It builds. It builds. And at some point, it sort of overflows. I talked to many survivors who I said, "Why did you come forward or start talking about your story?" And for so many, they connected when they saw two things. One was the grave finding at Kamloops in 2021. For so many, I had people telling me, that's when I called my son or daughter and said, "I need to tell you what happened to me at a boarding school in the United States." That was triggering for folks. Started making people feel that they could talk about their story. And the other thing was, remember all those sad cases of sexual abuse in Boston of children in the choir. That was another sort of flashpoint, I would call it, where many people said, "Wait a minute, abuse like that was happening to us, to Indians, and nobody talked about it." And they were doing the same patterns of moving around priests with troubles, except the huge difference was Native children, sadly, had been taken from their homes and they had lost their parents and their families who were their best advocates. And can you imagine? I can hardly say it, of your child being taken from you and you have no idea what's happening to them. That's how it perpetuated and was allowed to continue to happen. But when people saw those stories coming out, many survivors started feeling more comfortable of saying aloud, "This happened to me too. And I was abused, and my story should be heard." Those were big moments, and they still exist even today. Sadly, there's many folks who feel like education should be a shared universal thing for all people. But there are folks who are still scared of educational systems because of the trauma that they suffered at Indian boarding schools. They're nervous about their children or grandchildren going to schools because their experiences were so harsh, such filled with punishment. Children were taught basic reading, writing, and arithmetic to be work on farms or for women to do housework. They weren't being trained to be doctors and lawyers in the same way. And that's fear. Sadly, still exist in so many ways. How you parent has impacted so many survivors that I've talked to. That I never saw good parenting because I was always beaten or mistreated by those who were in charge of the school. They called them matrons, even if it wasn't a religious school. They were often called matrons, the men or women who worked in the dorms taking care of the children. And they themselves were working. They were responsible for the children all the time. There's no excuse for abuse in any way, but the system was set up so, so terribly with no oversight, no accountability, that these children were just left to their own with no one to advocate for them. And when you push down that and you don't talk about it, you really become sort of an overflowing volcano at some point. Sadly, I've talked to folks who say I turned to vices, to alcohol, to drugs, and it took me either meeting a partner or figuring out the right therapy and help to get me through that. And so many folks are still working on their healing journey. I've had people tell me their stories. I got to know them so well, and they would say, I've never told my wife parts of what happened to me at boarding school because it was so, so hurtful, so hurtful. Only as they got space, time away from it, were they able to really process what had happened to them. And that impacts how we parent, that impacts how you deal with job situations. I know many survivors who say, I had a short temper, I didn't know how to deal with things in a job when I was criticized because I was so afraid of the retribution. It really impacts your behavior when you're a young person and you don't learn sort of the quote unquote right ways to behave in certain situations when you don't have role models. That reverberates throughout life, and we're all teachers, and in Native culture, especially, elders are our teachers. So if our elders have not been taught and then they're teaching the next generation, they at times will have struggles of how to teach that and how to pass that on. I think Michelle's quote says it so best. Of, you know, she knew that she was loved, but her parents didn't know how to express it. I talked to so many children of boarding school survivors who say, my parents worked very hard, but they didn't know how to express their love. They didn't know how to just give me a hug or pat on the back. And it really does have a ripple impact. And some people get to a point in life where they're able to reflect and talk about it. And sadly, some people just literally take it to their grave where they can't process it and they can't talk about it. When I give speeches in person, I wear this dress that was made by Dora Broughtpunny, who is a boarding school survivor and I dare say became a friend. Hmm. And Dora was mistreated. I'll never forget her story because she recalled to me being taken, literally taken by men in quote unquote black suits and put in a black car out of her classroom. She never got to go back to say goodbye to her grandparents. She was sent with the clothes on her back to boarding school for years. As she became an adult, she sought therapy and she would tell a therapist about what happened to her. Some of them had never even heard, Rose, of Indian boarding schools, or they dismissed what had happened to her. Saying this couldn't possibly have happened under the U.S. government, just denying it. I can't even imagine how that would make me feel if you've gone through these horrible things of abuse and mistreatment and you're trying to tell someone and a therapist about it to seek help and being denied. Again, accountability, acknowledgement that you were wronged. She spent so much of her life trying to find somebody to listen to her story, went through bouts of sort of giving up on telling it, and then she sort of found the right thing for her. And you know what that was? It was her sewing. And it was making Native American clothing that she says she was never allowed to wear when she was a child and growing up at one of these schools. Wow. And that to me is so powerful because she makes beautiful modern clothing with Native American accents, and it's vibrant and it's culturally appropriate and powerful. And to wear that dress, I have such pride. And people always ask me, where did you get that dress? And I say, from a very special person who's one of the strongest people I know. And that was her outlet. That became her therapy. And doing art, I have one of her art pieces, and it's of nuns screaming at her. And she's a young child with this long, beautiful hair. And I once asked her, she said, this is a piece I always had in my mind. And she would get in trouble at the school for drawing, and they would call it doodling and take her paper and rip it up and smack her hands or punish her with holding food. As she got older, again, she would draw out as an artist or sketch out or paint out the abuse that happened to her. She found sort of her vibe and her way to deal with the pain that she had suffered through her sewing and through her artwork. And so some people are still finding that way to heal. And for each person, it's different, but I always admired Dora Brought Plenty that she sadly had sought professional help. And she found that through her artwork and through her using her own talents that she had very much been punished for at the school, she's now able to deal with the trauma and pain that she had gone through. That's powerful, right?
Wow. A really incredible story, Dana. We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk about your story. This is a very disturbing one, but it's so important. It's related to what you've just been discussing, the one that's called In the Name of God. This piece you and your colleagues wrote last May, it was very hard to read, but again, people need to know. You write that for decades, Catholic priests, brothers and sisters raped or molested Native children who were taken from their homes. You start with the story of Clarita Vargas, who was 8 when she was forced to live at St. Mary's Mission, a Catholic-run Indian boarding school in Omak, Washington, that was created under a U.S. government policy to strip Native kids of their identities. A priest took her and other girls to his office to watch a TV movie, then groped and fondled her as she sat on his lap, the beginning of 3 years of sexual abuse. Vargas, 64 at the time, said, "It haunted me my entire life." You tell the story of Geraldine Dubort, one of 9 sisters who said they were sexually or physically abused by priests at a boarding school in Marty, South Dakota. She said when she was 16, a Catholic priest repeatedly raped her in a church basement, and a doctor and several Catholic sisters later forced her to have an abortion. Geraldine Dubort, 75, said, "If somebody says you get over the abuse, trust me, you don't get over it." So these stories you've heard over and over again. Can you talk about this? Because this was pervasive sexual abuse.
It really was. And sadly, as one of the lawyers involved in that case said, is these children were really trapped. Mm. Right. And that's sadly the mindset of a predator in a way. These were predators of children, and they knew that, and they held such insane amount of scary power over children, and they abused that so badly. Clarita had told us that the priest who abused her repeatedly told her that if she refused him, she would not go to heaven. Would lock her in a rat-infested cellar. Mm. It's hard for us to imagine, for myself, Rose, to even imagine such severe fear to be put in a child, even us as adults. That's just the horrors of this. This is pervasive abuse. To this day, I remember her saying that she still doesn't like chocolate. And the reason is because he would lure them to his office on Sunday nights to watch TV, give them cocoa, chocolate chip cookies, and chocolate bars. Mm. It was considered a treat. And then in a sick way, he'd sit in his recliner and invite the girls to sit on his lap and rub their backs. Completely inappropriate, Rose. And stuck with Clarita Vargas so much through her life that she said the smell of chocolate, her grandchildren will offer her chocolate, and just makes her nauseous. All the way back from that being a child. The impact of that is still so powerful. A dear colleague, a dear friend of mine, Marionette Pember, who works for Indian Country Today and who's done a ton of powerful, great, sad, hard work on Indian boarding schools, has been writing about it for years for that publication and others, recently had her book came out, Medicine River, about her mother's experience at Red Cloud Indian School and how that impacted her family. And I've been listening to it on audiobook, and at times it stops me and I get a lump in my throat because you realize that Marionette now is a grown woman. Her mother has since passed, rest her soul, but you realize that had an impact on my friend Marionette years later. She couldn't figure out at times why her mother would shake her hands uncontrollably. And it was all from trying to rid herself of what she so often sadly heard at the boarding school, which was, "You're dirty Indian." Can you imagine? I mean, I can't even imagine Rose being called that and kind of the psychological impact of that. So often that's similar stories I've heard from people who, as they got to be adults and reflected on their parents' behavior who had been at boarding schools, they couldn't figure it out as they were growing up, but they realized much of it was in reaction to the abuse that they had suffered. And that takes a toll. And that's when we say intergenerational trauma, people say, well, what does that mean? Why does this matter now? The reason that matters now is because it's still being felt and impacted throughout Indian country.
Dana, we have very little time. A lot of people are writing to say thank you for your reporting. A few people are asking, why couldn't parents get their children?
Oh, very good question. There were actually laws passed by Congress that prohibited you and was mandatory to send your children to these schools. And if you tried to take your children, the rations that the government was giving you, remember at this time, Natives have been forced onto reservations. They're depending on the government for their food. Gone are the buffalo, basically. I'm trying to quickly talk through Indian history here, Indian History 101. If you're not able to feed your other children, they're were a group of Hopi Indians that were actually sent to Alcatraz. They went to prison, were sent to prison for refusing to send their children. The government mandated that Indians send their children. Remember, Indians were wards of the state. Indians did not have the right to vote at this time. They were under control of the federal government. They were called incompetent. They weren't even considered citizens. So it's not that easy, quote unquote, easy to resist. We talked to one boarding school descendant. His grandmother would tell him stories of how the women on their tribal lands in Montana would hold on to the wagons when the soldiers would come and take kids from their homes to the boarding schools. And those soldiers would use the butt of their rifles to beat their fingers off and push them back and literally run them over. Wow. They would do raids and take them all at once.
Well, Dana, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but we'd love to have you back. So many people are thanking you for your work. Dana Hedgepeth is a Native American journalist. You can find her Washington Post reporting online, extensive reporting about Indian boarding schools. Thank you so much, Dana, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.